Welcome to another edition of Strategic Planning for Business Owners. My name is Steve Young. I am a Senior Vice President of Wealth Management at UBS Financial Services. I run a team known as the Business Transition Consulting Group. We focus on the unique needs of owners of closely held businesses, mostly in the realm of strategic exit planning. We do a lot of pre-transaction analysis and post-exit wealth management. Today, I'm excited because my guest is a good friend of mine from way back when, Terry O'Neill. Terry and I have known each other for quite some time. Terry is a partner at Kat Sapper & Miller, based out of Indianapolis. But Terry has a very unique and special niche, which I'm happy to bring him on and have him tell us a little bit about. We're going to be talking about M&A transactions in the veterinarian space. So, Terry, welcome to the show today.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
Good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, it's exciting. Yes, great. Thank you for joining us. Before we get started in some of the questions and conversations around the topic, if you don't mind, take just a few minutes and share your background with our listeners.
Sure thing. Thank you. As you mentioned, I'm a partner in charge of the veterinary services group at KSM. We're a full-service CPA firm, but I've dedicated my professional career to the veterinary profession, and we work with veterinary hospitals all across the country, helping them guide them through business operations, how to increase profitability, buy and sell side transactions, and anything else that comes up that challenges a business owner. And one of the things that we've done for the last 13 years is data compilation with an organization called the Veterinary Management Groups. And approximately 700 hospitals are feeding all of their financial metrics into a database that we maintain and then republish. So we believe that we're very real time on what's going on and the trends in the market and what the most profitable hospitals are. I have a wonderful team of about 20 people that work full time with me. And then, as I like to mention to a number of folks in my previous life, before I returned back to the public accounting world, I was a minority partner in the process of buying in to 8 veterinary hospitals here in the Indianapolis market. So I sat on the veterinary owner side of the desk and all of the administrative folks, and I've worked every position in a small animal hospital. So I think it gives me a little bit of a deeper understanding of really the challenges that these veterinary owners and their teams face on a daily basis.
I would definitely attest to that just from knowing you from so many years back. And that's, I believe, I'm trying to count how many years we've known each other, but it's a couple decades at least. You and I met back in my old lending days. And at that time, you were working very heavily in the veterinarian space. And it's really interesting to see your progression into really a national presence in the industry. Everybody I've talked to in the veterinarian industry from the East Coast to the West Coast knows your name. And as
thank you.
Steve. Absolutely. Yeah. You guys have done phenomenal work.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. We're pretty humble over here. And I think it's been over 27 years we've been doing business together. So I try to surround myself with a lot smarter people than myself. And you're absolutely one of them when it comes to the investment advisory consultations that you provide to almost all of my clients that I represent.
I appreciate that. Well, speaking of which, let's kind of turn to some of the nuts and bolts of the industry, especially as it pertains to M&A. You and I had started this conversation probably 4 or 5 years ago where there was a lot of consolidation going on in the veterinarian space. And I think the listeners would find it interesting to hear your perspective on what really sparked that demand for veterinarian hospitals and the playing field for the consolidation of such. Obviously, that has changed quite a bit from then to now. So maybe give us a little information about how that came about and where we are today.
Yeah, sure. No, that's a pretty loaded, good question. So it might take me a while to answer it all. And I'd like to maybe approach it this way, if it's okay, and talk a little bit about the labor market, pet ownership, consolidation, and what we're seeing kind of across the country right now. So, and the pandemic too, the impact it's had for the last 36 months on the industry itself. So to be a little more current, maybe I'll touch on the COVID surge, let's say, for lack of a better way to say that. All of the hospitals we work with saw an unprecedented demand for veterinary services when COVID hit in the second quarter of 2020. Up through arguably the third quarter of 2022. The demand for veterinary services was very difficult and challenging, where hospitals were just overwhelmed. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, pet ownership skyrocketed people were adopting and bringing pets into their household. That's one issue. The other issue was fueled by the fact that people were working from home versus the office, and they were more attentive and aware of their pet's possible health care needs. So they would recognize something maybe a little bit more currently. Number three, disposable income to spend on veterinary care, in my opinion, was higher as a result of nobody traveling, nobody buying anything, mm-hmm. and basically just living at home. And they had a little bit more disposable income through a number of different federal subsidies that we saw in the marketplace. So that surge just absolutely put the veterinary industry at capacity. And what happened from a standpoint of the labor front, there's two issues to kind of address, is that the doctor staffing was very limited. The AVMA tells me regularly, one of my very good friends, Dr. Bridget Bain, a PhD economist, there's enough veterinarians graduating from the veterinary schools right now, but the challenge in the industry is the amount of time those graduates actually want to work. The norm is more of a 32-hour week versus a 40-hour week. So right there, we've got a 25% shortage. The other significant issue was unfortunately, the veterinary profession has one of the highest suicide rates of all professionals. And the challenge and the demands and just the fatigue associated with COVID is real. And real time, a lot of hospitals are still right in the middle of that. Even though invoice counts here in 2023 are declining, which is probably okay, because when we look back at 2021 and 22, they were record highs. And so they're still dealing with that. The other side of the equation was being in a position to hire competent support staff, technicians, customer service representatives to answer the front desk, people to work in the kennel, technician assistants or nurse equivalents. So the challenge with that, based on the feedback I get, and I believe it to be true, and I've kind of come to my own conclusion, that number one, the government subsidies sure didn't help small businesses with respect to requiring people to have a job. They were able to survive on, instead of two people in a home working, they were able to survive with one person in the government subsidies. And the other issue that's still an issue, but not as prevalent was dependable daycare. And so you kind of wrap the overwhelming demand, doctors not wanting to work 40 hours a week and not having enough support staff, it just stretched the veterinary industry like a rubber band. So we're still feeling, I like to call it a hangover from COVID. And I don't think there's a long-term solution to that other than the utilization of technology and really laser focus on how to be efficient and how pet care is delivered at the hospital. So that's the COVID and labor things that we see out there. From a standpoint of the other question you had wrapped into that loaded one you gave me, Steve, was, what's going on in the consolidation world? And this has been, consolidation has been going on for, 20 plus years. But consolidation 20 years ago, the buyers were financially astute and they weren't overpaying, in my opinion. I'm not a private equity guy. That's what Steve's the investment guy. But, from a private equity standpoint, companies were, traditionally a veterinary hospital will be valued at a multiple, let's say, of 5x earnings. And we could spend 3 hours talking about how to calculate earnings, but let's just go with the fact that the earnings that a buyer would expect to be entitled to if they bought a hospital. And the buyers were paying, maybe 6, sometimes 7x earnings. So a little bit of a premium, maybe more than a little, maybe a 20 to 40% premium on what an individual independent doctor could borrow the money for and buy the hospital. But the main consolidator back in the early days was VCA, and they brought economies of scale with buying power and back office solutions and marketing and all this other stuff that solo hospitals couldn't provide. So they made up that differential paying a premium by having a support team behind the hospital and the economies of scale. Well, somewhere in the, mid-2010 to 2015, don't quote me on the exact dates, a couple other companies saw what VCA was doing and said, hey, this is a very fragmented industry. It's very much in demand. And you look at the demographics of the owners, I think it's a good industry to invest in. So these private equity firms would go out and borrow money or have investment dollars come in or some combination thereof. Most of them have a combination thereof where they're borrowing and have investment dollars. And they started buying hospitals at the 7 or 8 times earnings, a little bit more than a premium for BCA. But the investment folks on the private equity markets were saying, hey, we think your business is worth 10 times earnings. So if you do the quick math, it's pretty easy. I'll buy a hospital at 7 or 10 times, but then my investors say I'm worth 10. As long as I can go in there and not screw it up and maintain my level of profitability, we get significant investor appreciation on every acquisition. Well, once two or three other companies got involved, now flash forward to 2023, it's arguable there's 50 different companies out there buying veterinary hospitals. And the consolidation world, based on a report from my good friend John Volk at the Brackey Institute out of Chicago, he estimates that over 50% of all the small animal revenue in the United States is owned by private equity-backed companies.
Wow.
So, yeah, you say, wow, it's about 30% of the locations, but they've got a stronghold. You know, the UK is arguably 80%. Hmm. And what happened during the frenzy and the economics that our country and the world was in back in 2020 is when things just absolutely skyrocketed, where people were, you know, selling hospitals for 8 to 10 times earnings. But in 2015, I don't quote me on the year, that's when National Veterinary Associates, another worldwide provider, was recapitalized at 13 times earnings. And all of a sudden, you had all these other companies come in, and to be competitive in the marketplace, they had to pay more. And we hit a peak when COVID hit. These investors were saying, oh my gosh, this industry is absolutely economic gold because of its fragmentation and the demand for services that can't be met. And when we hit our all-time high, we got involved probably, Steve, with, I can't even remember, but it was for 2.5 straight years, we had 20-plus live sell transactions. And so we were probably working on anywhere from 60 to 80 transactions a year, helping our clients. And the first thing that I'll get back into the multiples and what's happened to them here momentarily, but the first thing I always ask our clients to do if they're thinking about selling is I remind them it never makes financial sense to sell your hospital. You can never put the money after taxes in a bank and get the same return on your investment. But if Steve at UBS says, Terry, if you sell your hospital for X number of dollars, you'll never have to worry about money again, I think you owe it to yourself and your family as a veterinary owner to take that phone call. That's what we're all in business for, right? We all love what we do most days, but when that proverbial opportunity presents itself, I think you owe it to yourself. But what we saw in the multiples ran up as high, Steve, if you can believe this, and I know you do because you helped me on a lot of transactions, to 13 to 15 times earnings.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just mind-blowing valuation multiples. Absolutely zero margin for error, in my opinion. And I literally sat here in my office on a weekly basis and stared out the window at the highway like, what am I missing? What am I missing? That how can these financial investors sleep at night knowing that they're paying such high multiples? Well, the answer was the fact that they were paying 13 to 15 times and they anticipated and expected to be valued by the public markets and other investors at 20 to 25. And I'll be damned if two of them didn't pull it off. AmeriVet and Thrive, the old pathway. They were successful and actually recapitalized, and it was extremely lucrative for their investors and the sellers that invested in them. And so when that happened, then all of a sudden, they continued on that torrid pace for second half of 20. Then in 21, I believe, the president had mentioned that they were looking at increasing the capital gains tax rate. That had another flood of people like, I'm getting out if rates are going up to 37% mm-hmm. cap gains. I'm going to sell at 20% and save that 17%. So that made sense. So that frenzy continued up through the first kind of decline in valuation multiples was fueled by one of the consolidators that couldn't get recapitalized and literally had to walk away from a number of transactions we were involved in, and others took note of that. And all of a sudden, over the course of the last 6 months of last year and the first 6 months of this year, when people call me, I tell them, you're not even going to approach 13 to 15 times. That's not even in the cards. You're probably looking at 6 to 8 times earnings. which takes us all the way back about 20, 25 mm-hmm. years ago, kind of where VCA was at. You might be able to squeeze the deal a little bit more, but there's so many different moving parts with respect to how the hospital is valued, number one. Number two, what the building lease terms may or may not be if the owner owns the building. Number three, what the employment term is going to be. Is it 1, 2, or 5 years? A bunch of really good questions. I know in my previous life when we sold our business, the only reason we sold our business is my partner at the time, the age of 38 years old, could have financially retired. He didn't, but he could have. So we had to take that phone call. I do try to practice what I preach. Then mm-hmm. the other component of that is the consideration that's being paid. How much cash at close, how much seller financing, and how much stock are they going to, how much of their own stock they're going to use to buy you. And so I always recommend, like I said before, talk to your investment advisor, talk to Steve at UBS. They've done literally dozens of transactions with us over the years. They can run the financial analysis. And that if your cash at closing satisfies those buckets, and Steve says, I'm pretty confident or 90% confident that this is going to be your golden ticket, then I kind of consider the seller financing and the stock you get, that lack of a better way to say it, Steve, you're in the money and you're leaving the money on the table. You're pulling the chips off the table in Vegas for closing, but you're leaving the others ride. And you may or may not get paid those amounts. And as long as our clients acknowledge that it's probably one of the riskiest investments they're going to make, by taking on subordinated debt and non-voting minority shares that have no put options, as long as they understand that and they check the box, then I'm a big cash at closing guy. So sorry for such a long-winded answer, Steve, but boy, you gave me a load of money.
Next time I'll learn to break it down. There's a lot to unpack in that, Terry, but thank you. That's great background, and appreciate all the detail in that one answer to that one question. Just to kind of piggyback on a few things that you had touched on, I mean, one of the nice things that we've done, your firm and our firm and your team and our team, is really gotten to know the space very well and worked with a lot of veterinarians across the United States going through various stages of analysis and trying to figure out if the deal makes sense for them. And a couple of comments you made a few minutes ago, really, when it comes to taking a look at an offer, I think there was that period of time where even though the veterinarian might have been, you know, I'd say relatively still young in their career with lots of working years ahead of them, it comes a point in time where the deal is just too good to turn down. And we've had those conversations with your clients in the past. You had mentioned being able to be confident in the retirement side of it. And I think what you're referring to is the pre-transaction analysis that our team takes the clients through. We basically help them articulate what their long-term goals and objectives are. And then we take a look at the after-tax cash that comes from the transaction. And you touched on the fact that there's generally a number of different components in that transaction. There's going to be the cash amount. There's going to be generally an employment contract or an agreement to work for a certain number of years, a certain dollar amount per year. There could potentially be some seller financing, although I don't think I've seen too much of that lately. But more prevalent, I see, is the roll-up of equity with the buyer. And that's something that we help quantify, but we basically, like you said, kind of leave the chips on the table. We want to make sure that the owners can actually walk away with the cash component of the deal and have a comfortable scenario without having to rely on getting those equity shares cashed out at some point in time in the future, because that's a risk that we just can't really quantify too well. We don't have good insight on what that might hold. And there's a lot of various factors that go into play as to whether or not that recapitalization would happen, and if so, when and at what level. So we quantify a lot of what we do based on the cash at closing and take a look at that along with our capital markets assumptions and how we would actually allocate that money in the market to determine whether or not there's a high, low, or medium probability of successfully reaching the outcomes that they're trying to accomplish through that sale.
Well said.
Thank you. Thank you. And that's, I think, the beauty of the partnership that we've developed over the years working with your team is having that understanding and being able to take clients through that process. And sometimes the answer is, hey, you know what? That's not the right amount of money for me to do what I need to do. And maybe we don't move forward with this transaction. Or maybe we have unrealistic expectations with today's market, given where we were, say, 2 and 3 and 4 years ago. And I think you're probably seeing a lot of that with your clients now. You're probably having those conversations.
We are. And, you know, the other part of the equation that I always like to tell everybody is that more likely than not, they will go to their grave second-guessing themselves as to when they sold their business and to whom. My partner and I liquidated our business back on September 23rd of 1994, not that I remember the date, Steve. And every time we get together and talk, we always reminisce, like, what would it have been like if I stayed in business? And the other side of it, I don't know if you've seen as much, Steve, but about a third of the business owners that have sold that are below the age of 60, let's say, not to give an exact demographic, have their toe back in the water in some type of entrepreneurship and some type of business, whether it's supporting their loving spouse on something they've always wanted to do, and or they're back in the game in the veterinary business again once their non-compete's up. So I just think that's fascinating.
No, I'd agree. There's only so much golf you can play, and there's only so much time you can spend sitting on the beach. And generally, most people that go in business at one point or another in their life do that because the way they're wired. And for them to sit still for too long makes them uncomfortable, and they need to get back and do something. And we do have a lot of that conversation with owners as they're thinking about selling their business as to, okay, there's the financial part of the transaction, and then there's the life part of the transaction. What's life going to be like after you transition out of your company? You know, a lot of these people have, well, let me ask you this. I mean, in the conversations we've had with veterinarians, I mean, none of them really went into the veterinarian space to get rich, at least in my opinion. They went into the space because they're caring individuals, they love animals, and they wanted to make a difference in the lives of animals and their owners. And so when an opportunity like this arises and they have the ability to monetize their business, it's a very emotional process that they have to go through to decide whether or not they want to transition out or not. And if they do, who's going to take over? As you said, who are they selling to? And are they going to treat their clients the same way that they treated the clients? Are they going to treat the employees the same way that they treat the employees? I would imagine you're having the same conversations with your clients as well.
Yeah. I mean, as I tell them, I quite honestly don't know what I'm going to do in my life once I hang the cleats up, Steve, but I'm looking forward to that next chapter at some point in time. And I always internally joke with myself, you know, I'm just going to be the second hand on some fishing charter boat down someplace where it's warm year round, and just, you see what happens, put it that way. It's funny that you mentioned that about the caring nature of their personalities, and they are. You hit it spot on. And I always laugh at my father, who's a retired investment advisor like yourself. And he always told me, after he retired, he always joked that he never knew how he worked because he was so busy in his retirement days with his volunteering and everything he always wanted to do in life, he finally had a chance to. So I'm looking forward to me and you playing some golf.
That sounds nice. Well, listen, I'm looking at the clock and we're bumping up on the time. This has been great conversation, and you and I have had many, many conversations like this in the past, and we could probably go on for hours, but I want to be respectful of your time today as well as the listeners. And just wrapping up here, in any last minute thoughts, if there's a veterinarian out there listening to this podcast, or maybe there's another advisor listening to this podcast that has a veterinarian client, is there anything specifically you'd like to talk about or departing nuggets of wisdom for people listening today?
Yeah, so I'll keep it fairly short, Steve, but you know, I guess I usually answer that question with a couple of comments that some of the hospitals that we work with, and including my own practice here and what we provide, business was so extremely robust during the COVID surge. We kind of all developed some habits that we shouldn't have, where we kind of got used to saying no more than we should have. And we were in a position where we were both hospitals and my business was under some labor staffing issues. We tolerated some behavior, maybe just because we had such a need for assistance, we kind of had to look the other way versus trying to not discipline, but change that behavior of somebody, for lack of a better way to say it. And just to give a little backdrop. So my theme now for 2023 and beyond is back to basics. Okay. The surge was real. It's back to manageable. Doctors are seeing the same number of patients per quarter as they were in the fourth quarter of 2019. So we're back to a manageable work style and lifestyle, but hospitals, to be successful in the future, I'm adamant about the fact that you've got to embrace technology and efficiency solutions. You've got to stick back to your basics and really focus on two things. employee satisfaction, number one, so you don't have turnover and you're the magnet for employees, and customer satisfaction through great service and medical care. If hospitals can focus on those two things, then we can begin the financial discussion as to improve their profitability. It's an extremely challenging business to run and manage. I know it, and hospitals also, the third really, really important part of the equation for successful ownership is mentorship of your team, and being okay with talking about mental illness and challenges because it's real, and it's okay to talk about it, and don't try to hide behind anything. I never want to take a phone call to find out that a friend of mine has taken their life because they couldn't put up with the challenges associated with being a veterinarian. I think it's healthy to talk about that, Steve.
Now, I appreciate you bringing that up. That is a major concern, and that's probably a topic for another conversation, because there's so much that can be unpacked in that one comment about mental health, especially there's a lot of factors that cause that, and I think a lot of that has been magnified by the pandemic as well, but there's more to that, as I said, and as you're well aware of as well. But again, we're bumping up time here, and again, this has been extremely insightful. There's a ton of information that you've been able to provide to us in a very short period of time. I wanted to just let everybody listening to this podcast know that if you wanted more information about anything we talked about today, if you wanted to get involved with Terry and his team, learn more about the Veterinarian Management Study Group that Terry's involved with on a national level, please reach out. You can reach out to me. My phone number is 317-816-1830. My email is steven.young@ubs.com. I'll make sure that we get Terry involved if any questions you have for him specifically. And with that, I would say thank you, Terry, for joining us this morning for the recording of this podcast. And thank you again. And for everybody tuning in and listening today, appreciate your time and wish everybody having a great day.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.